I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Time. Superstorm Sandy's fury was unleashed on the eastern seaboard yesterday and lived up to its reputation. The heavy rains and the storm surge flooded many of the communities along the coastline. 2 million people in New Jersey and 1 million in Pennsylvania don't have power. 400,000 homes and businesses in Delaware are without power. Many roads are impassable in the tri-state area. Public transit is shut down for now. Government offices are closed. And so are schools. Joining us is Mitchell Gaines. He's a meteorologist in the Mount Holly, New Jersey office of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Weather Service. And Mitchell Gaines, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Where is Sandy today?
Sandy today is currently continuing to move west and further inland and away from our region. From that, we had very strong winds and heavy rains that moved through last night. Winds will still be gusty, however, today, up to 25 miles an hour in terms of sustained winds, potential gusts up to 50, so it could still be a very windy day out there as we try to begin the cleanup.
And I noticed yesterday and even this morning it's being described as a cyclone. Is that the operative word?
Yes. The technical term is a post-tropical cyclone. And the difference between a tropical cyclone and a wintertime cyclone, since it has changed its characteristics, is the energy source. Tropical cyclones extract their heat from the ocean and grow by releasing heat into the atmosphere near the storm center. However, wintertime cyclones, which is what Sandy transitioned to, also called the extratropical phrasing, get most of their energy from temperature contrast in the atmosphere with that energy spread out over larger areas. So that's why we saw that it went from being a hurricane to a post-tropical cyclone upon landfall yesterday evening.
Now, yesterday, as it was coming up the coast, described as 800 to 1,000 miles wide. Do we know how wide Sandy is today?
Sandy is still fairly wide. Its impacts are being felt all the way with snow in the Appalachians and Ohio Valley to heavy rains and winds extending all the way up into New England as well.
And who got the heaviest amount of rain so far?
So far, majority of our heaviest rain totals within our county warning area here in the Philadelphia region have been across Delaware, Eastern Shore, Maryland, and extreme southern New Jersey.
And how much rain are we talking about?
Some areas have received our highest rainfall totals this last night were around 11 inches.
Wow.
We're going through the data through the remainder of the day today, and we'll post some updated numbers on rainfall totals.
And how about wind speed? What was the highest it was clocked?
The highest clocked in our region was just under 90 miles an hour. We had several reports in that 80 to 90 mile an hour range for highest wind gusts.
We're, of course, reading about what's happening in New York City. The city itself seems to have been really hit hard by Sandy. Why is that?
Well, New York City was not fortunate in that it was on the northeast side of Sandy. All the water moving around the storm collected and was pulled onshore in those regions. Since you got that onshore flow, and you have New York City in between two land masses, you got a considerable amount of water, which had nowhere else to go but to pile into the New York City area.
We're also getting reports of snow in places like West Virginia, and some of the more mountainous parts of the eastern part of the United States. What can you tell us, Mitchell, about that?
Several reports of snow have occurred out in West Virginia. Heavy wet snow out there, which results in downed trees and power lines for people in West Virginia as well. There could be some areas that see well over a foot of snow out in the mountainous regions of Pennsylvania and West Virginia.
And is that because of the cold front that kind of hit Sandy?
Yeah, there was a frontal boundary that moved through the region and interacted with Sandy. And that's brought in more fall-like air mass, and with the moisture of Sandy moving back into those regions, it's been cold enough to support snowfall.
And how do you see this storm then moving as it moves west across the U.S. and perhaps even falling apart?
Sandy will continue to weaken throughout the day today and through tomorrow as it lingers across the Northeast. For the majority of people, that will result in winds diminishing gradually over the course of the next couple of days. But again, today will still be very windy, even though the winds will be less than yesterday. And those winds will continue to slowly wind down through the rest of the upcoming week. The heavy areas of rain will diminish to showers, and eventually by the end of the week, we should even see the sunshine again.
And this is talking about the tri-state area here in the Philadelphia area?
Yes, that is correct.
And you don't want to overhype a storm, but from your experience as a meteorologist, how does Sandy compare to some of the other storms that have unleashed their fury on the eastern seaboard?
Well, we had a Hurricane Irene last year that caused a lot of damage. I think Irene paralleled the coast, while in the case with Sandy, it was more of a direct hit that actually had the rare occurrence of moving westward across our region, which caused the impact to go even further inland and be felt in more areas than directly in with Sandy than Irene.
Is it one for the history books, do you think?
Yes, it will most likely be a noteworthy storm that some will be talking about for years to come.
Well, Mitchell Gaines, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right, well, thank you again for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a meteorologist at the Mount Holly, New Jersey office of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's NOAA's National Weather Service. And joining us now is Dave Schrader. He's Director of Communications and National Spokesperson for the American Red Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And Dave Schrader, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Where did you spend last night?
I spent my night at Cheltenham High School in Montgomery County, one of our 15 shelters that we had open in the region.
And how many people were there with you?
It was one of our smaller ones. We had about 11, which was probably our second smallest.
And what kinds of people were there? And by that, I mean, are we talking about children?
There was one child. It was mostly elderly residents, all from the immediate area.
And how many shelters were set up in the Philadelphia region?
In the southeastern Pennsylvania, we had 15 shelters, and that number is now 14. We closed a shelter this morning. We closed the Cheltenham one this morning as everyone had a place to go. We're able to return home.
And doing a nose count, how many people used the Red Cross shelters?
649 spent the night last night in a Red Cross shelter in the southeastern Pennsylvania. 11,000 people altogether along the East Coast.
Along the East Coast. And in the southeastern Pennsylvania area, what was the capacity? What were you able to handle?
We had cots ready to go for 3,500 people. We didn't have all those set up, but they were adjacent to the shelters themselves. So we were nowhere near our cot capacity.
And one thing we know, or we learned, I think, from Katrina and some of these other storms, which is that people are reluctant to leave their homes if they think they are going to leave their pets behind. How has the Red Cross accommodated pet owners?
Well, that was a huge success for us this time around. We have great partnerships with the local CART agencies, which are basically animal rescue response teams in each of the counties, and they partnered with us to provide pet care at almost all of our shelters, so residents could feel free to bring their pets and know they would be taken care of very well.
We are also learning that some people did not heed warnings, and I know part of the job of the Red Cross is to provide preparedness, emergency services for people. Looking back, what should people have done to prepare for this storm?
I know there are some people who may not have. I think Philadelphia and Greater Philadelphia region have responded very well. I think most people did heed the warnings. I know I was out on the roads a little bit yesterday afternoon, and it was pretty deserted. So people did seem to choose to stay home and heed the warnings. I think people sometimes still don't take it seriously. They think, oh, I can deal. I can make it through anything. And people are reluctant to just leave their house because, you know, it is their home. So I understand that, but
sure.
People really need to take the warning seriously. I'd rather have you be in a shelter for the night and have it not be a big deal than have you stay at your house and have it turn into a big deal.
And a big deal is making sure you have batteries, making sure you have water. I mean, all those sort of basic preparedness measures.
Yes. Yes, and I think people did do that. I mean, stores were sold out of many of the key items, so I think people certainly took that advice.
And what about the couple days after the storm when there is cleanup? Sometimes there are down wires. I mean, things that people should be careful of.
Oh, yeah, certainly you don't want to be – if you're there's down wires, you don't want to touch it. You want to avoid it. You want to make sure you report it. You also want to make sure that check around your house for any sharp objects. Use gloves. Try to maybe even use goggles if you have them or some sort of eyewear. And if you have flooding in your basement, if there's water in your basement, if it's something that cannot be cleaned, you need to throw it out because you don't know what's in that water. So if it cannot be cleaned, throw it out. If it was food of any kind, you need to throw it out. If your power has been out, if your food has been out for 2 to 3 or 4 hours, you need to ditch it. Any imperishable foods have been out like that are not edible, particularly meat and eggs and things like that. So those are kind of the key things people should keep in mind as they clean up.
And just to underscore that, we're hearing that about 2 million people in New Jersey, about 1 million in Pennsylvania, 400,000 at least homes and businesses in Delaware, at least at this point, are without power.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest concerns going into the power outages, no question.
And how about giving blood? I mean, is that needed? Yes. under circumstances such as this?
Yes, very much so, actually. Red Cross has been very diligent about asking areas in non-affected areas of the country to donate blood because dozens and dozens of blood drives had to be canceled or postponed because of the hurricane. And that's blood that is still desperately needed by hospitals along the East Coast and across the country. So if you have the opportunity, blood donations should be picking up again very soon. So we urge you to donate blood if you can.
We're almost out of time here, but you're talking as Director of Communications for the American Red Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And again, as I said to our meteorologist, it looks like New York City was hit hard by this storm. Has that been your reporting as well?
I have a couple colleagues who live in New York and are living around New York, and it's definitely a challenging time for them. But I think the Red Cross and the city management agencies have a pretty good handle on what's needed to be done, and Red Cross will be there to support whatever those efforts are.
Well, Dave Schrader, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's Director of Communications and National Spokesperson for the American Red Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania. We began our conversation with meteorologist Mitchell Gaines and, of course, talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And we want to hear from you how things are looking in your neighborhood. What did you do yesterday? Where are you today? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
7.45 miles. That's how long the course is for the 4th annual Y12K road race. Think you can handle it? Don't worry. There's also a relaxing 3K family walk run and the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. Sign up and hit the streets to support WHYY Saturday, November 10th. Runner or beginner, it's healthy fun for a good cause. Everyone's welcome. The course takes you from the Art Museum to Falls Bridge and back again. Visit whyy.org/Y12K.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about Hurricane Sandy barreling into this part of the United States. It is moving west, and we're curious about what has been happening in your neighborhood. President Obama signed a state of emergency declaration for the District of Columbia, Massachusetts, New York, Delaware, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Rhode Island, and New Jersey. This means that federal aid will be available for the affected states to meet these emergencies from Hurricane Sandy. Natural disasters are a big test for local, state, and federal government. Hurricane Katrina in 2005 is Exhibit A. Joining us is Scott Knowles, author of a book called The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. He's a professor at Drexel University, where his teaching and research focuses on the history of modern cities with a focus on risk and disaster. He also directs the university's Center for Interdisciplinary Inquiry. Scott Knowles, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. So how did the affected states and even the affected governments running those states, how did they do dealing with Hurricane Sandy?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is still a disaster in progress. The fact that the disaster declaration paperwork and requests were all done ahead of time is a really good sign, and I think that really shows part of what was learned after Hurricane Katrina. All the reports I've seen show that there's been really good integration between FEMA at the federal level, state and localities, and you know, even Chris Christie went on and praised FEMA and praised President Obama. So I think the early reports are that the response has been really quite robust.
But do you think that's in part because we have better technology to track these kinds of storms, and also that elected officials want to look prepared and have paid a price in the past when they haven't?
Well, I think certainly a storm that you can track like this for several days allows you to get the, in the emergency management world, I mean, that's a good thing because you can get the message out through media over and over again. At the same time, a lot of people didn't evacuate, so they still face this longstanding problem of trying to get the public to buy in. When you tell them, you know, the threat is coming your way, we can show you exactly where it is on the map, and people still don't get out of the way. So, yes, in one sense, I mean, we're seeing the sort of post-Katrina landscape of emergency management in the United States, and lessons learned. On the other hand, there's still some really, really huge challenges facing disaster preparedness and emergency managers.
Well, picking up on those people that did not heed those warnings, as you said, they were told, there were maps to look at, and they still hunkered down in what appeared to be, at least in some parts of the affected area, in pretty risky, vulnerable areas.
Right. I think there's maybe a sort of a fatigue that sets in with people who get repeated warnings that they need to evacuate. That's been pretty well documented in the research over the years. That's going to be a challenge, you know. And when governors, you know, have to go on TV and say, "Well, you know, this is it. You can either leave, or you know, we're not going to come get you." I mean, that's a tough moment for an executive to be in. Those are potential voters, but that's sort of what played out in some of these areas.
But I think on the other side, and perhaps even understandably, some people are just, first of all, some people I think can't leave. They don't have a car. They don't know where to go. Maybe they don't even have money to go somewhere. And I think some are just reluctant to leave the home that they love.
Well, I think you've tapped into the bigger, from my perspective, the bigger issue here, which is that FEMA has got, in some sense, just an impossible task, and so do state and local emergency managers. On the one hand, they have to deal with response. But there are other things. A disaster is a full cycle of activities. I mean, there's mitigation that happens years ahead, you know, making sure your seawall is in shape or making sure that you have an emergency operations center. There's sort of preparedness as you get ready for the storm. There's the immediate response, which we're seeing right now is pretty good, and then there's recovery after. Our emergency managers and FEMA is tasked with doing all of these things, but the majority of their budget is earmarked just for response. So you mentioned the folks who, you know, get these warnings and maybe don't get out of harm's way. Maybe they don't have the funds to do it. Maybe they don't trust government at the same level that others in our society might. That's a systemic problem that has to do with deferred maintenance on our infrastructure and deferred education in our citizens and poverty. I mean, you know, quite the reality, if you look at Katrina, is that the people who didn't get out were, by and large, people who were poor, who were economically marginalized, lower socioeconomic status in our society. And that is just a fact of disaster preparedness, and it's a hard one, because it's hard to get resources to deal with those issues when you frame them that way.
But it's so interesting to look at FEMA. It was created by President Carter. It has been promoted. It's been demoted, depending on, yes, on who the president is.
Right.
Why is there so much contention around FEMA?
It's the problem. One of the problems here is, I think, that Americans maybe don't realize how political disasters are. That, you know, the degree that, to which we prepare or don't prepare for a disaster is sort of a reflection of our national values. You know, and who's prepared and who isn't just a mistake. I mean, there's no such thing as a natural disaster. It doesn't just come out of the blue. The way that disasters affect us are a reflection of our national priorities. The reason FEMA's been caught up in the politics over the years is that its mission has changed from time to time. And that's because the perception of the dominant threat has changed over time. If you look, when FEMA was created, it was created in large part as a response to governors who said, the government is spending a lot of money preparing us for a nuclear attack, but we can't do anything about a nuclear attack. We have wildfires, floods, and earthquakes every year. Give us an agency that will help us respond to those. Carter was a governor. He reacted. He took action. When Reagan came into office, the agency moved back to its sort of civil defense, Cold War posture. When the Cold War ended, well, that opened up an opportunity for FEMA to take on natural hazards in a serious way. And in the 1990s, it did. After September 11, it was almost a reset. In a sense, on September 12, you moved FEMA and disaster preparedness in this country back to almost to 1950. We were back to fighting a war against terrorism rather than prioritizing the disasters that are in our midst and that we see every year. So FEMA's been caught up in that to and fro of national priorities around disasters.
But are you saying that, and you don't want to make equivalence between disasters, but I'm also thinking about September 11th. I'm thinking about New York today. And obviously after September 11th, a lot of the focus on combating terrorism and,
sure,
and being more alert and prepared for a potential attack. But we see New York today, and New York has been devastated by this storm.
Well, the fact is that emergency managers are trained to deal with all hazards. I mean, the idea that we could prepare individually for each different kind of hazard or disaster that faces us just is unworkable. Mm-hmm. And there's a ton of knowledge. I mean, the problem isn't knowledge. The problem is policy. There's a ton of knowledge and science and knowledge about operations that tells emergency managers, you know, at all levels, how to prepare for hazards broadly defined. And that includes acts of terrorism and technological failures and mm-hmm. and disasters. I mean, we've had over $400 billion in losses from weather-related disasters in the last 10 years. 9/11, depending on how you count it, cost about $100 billion. So the fact, I mean, that really forces us to kind of look at this seriously and say, you know, shouldn't we be preparing for terrorism and all of these other hazards at the same time? The fact is that our government, there was a massive restructuring after September 11. Natural hazards were demoted and terrorism became job one.
That's Scott Knowles, author of a book called The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. He's a professor at Drexel University, teaching, focusing his research on the history of modern cities with a focus on risk and disaster. We called him up, asked him to join us today at Radio Times as we take a look at Hurricane Sandy and the impact that that has had on the Eastern Seaboard. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Are you saying, Scott, that our response, we had a greater response to the threat of terrorism than we have to natural disasters?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security is the largest government agency. It was created since the New Deal. It was created in 2002. And, I mean, that just dwarfs anything that we've done around government restructuring in the aftermath of natural disasters. You know, so we've got 10 years now that we can look back. We've spent $1 trillion on counterterrorism. I think it's important to note, too, that FEMA in the 1990s was a cabinet-level agency under Director James Lee Witt, and President Clinton elevated it to that status. When the Bush administration came in, they demoted FEMA and ultimately put it under the Department of Homeland Security. So now its mission is hazards as well as counterterrorism. And they fight for resources in there. I mean, the overall Department of Homeland Security budget is about $65 billion. FEMA gets about $10 billion of that. And they have to do everything, what we're seeing right now, the kind of response they have to do, as well as to try to deal with mitigation, you know, preparing for disasters, as we were discussing before they occur. I mean, that's the long game.
Sure.
These disasters are becoming more frequent, they're becoming more costly, and they're becoming more deadly. Katrina, Hurricane Rita, Irene, and now Sandy. FEMA, again, just to point to the struggle they're facing, they have to deal with the response, but they also have to be aware that this is potentially the new normal around disasters in the United States. So how do they balance counterterrorism and hazard preparedness and protection? That's what they're facing.
And how does where is FEMA under the Obama administration? Is it a cabinet level position? Or?
No, it remains under the Obama administration did not change that. It remains under the aegis of the Department of Homeland Security. Although a very important and positive thing is that the administrator, the director of FEMA, Craig Fugate, comes from the emergency management world. Actually, he was in the fire service. He came out of Florida, actually. He'd served under a Republican. So it was a bipartisan choice. Everything I've read of it is that Obama went looking for a real expert, somebody who was respected, and he found one. And Fugate's done, I think, an admirable job. But you don't have to go too far back in FEMA's history to find Michael Brown, and his, the heck of a job brownie kind of things. I mean, we don't have to go too far back to find the sort of dark ages where FEMA's leadership was not expert.
But, you know, it's interesting. We have a presidential election, and it's a bit on hold as the East part of the country is dealing with this particular hurricane and the disaster related to the hurricane. But you do have, if you look at candidate Romney, Governor Romney, and President Obama, two very different visions about the role of the federal government when it comes to natural disasters.
I think that's right. I mean, but who would have thought the October surprise would have been something totally predictable, right, which would have been a hurricane in hurricane season.
Right.
Maybe not this disastrous of a hurricane, predictable. But no, I mean, it's unfolding here with a week to go. And you're right. They have very different visions, although it's been hard to find that out. I mean, I've been disappointed that all the billions and billions of dollars spent on this campaign and all the debates, we've heard almost nothing about climate change, very little about infrastructure protection, and I think one question at one debate about disaster preparedness. And that's a shame. Because these are disasters that are unfolding in our midst every year. The ideological divide is stark. President Obama is trying, I think, to... I think the seriousness of this is shown with having Craig Fugate there, is trying to allow FEMA to do response as well as to move back into mitigation the way it was in the 90s. Romney is on record in the debate in the spring saying that... FEMA should be shrunk and its activities should be moved to the states and ideally privatized. His vice presidential running mate, Paul Ryan, has said that basically these kinds of activities should be left to the state and the funding should be shrunk. That's a real problem for FEMA because its budget is small. And what happens every year, like clockwork, is that they run out of funds for disaster relief. And when that happens, that gets thrown into the floor of the Congress. We saw this after Hurricane Irene, where disaster relief was being debated on the floor of the Congress, and Eric Cantor said, we're not going to give relief until we see cost-cutting in other places. That's a shame to me that something which is a national priority and a marker of our sort of humanity gets debated on the floor of the Congress with real lives at stake.
But can states handle a disaster of this magnitude by themselves or even the private sector, as Governor Romney talks about?
Well, states had a chance to handle that for decades, and they couldn't. And that's why FEMA was created. FEMA was created at the behest of governors. Right. FEMA was created at the behest of local officials. FEMA's creation is a reflection of the states and the localities asking for help with coordination. So I think the answer to that, pretty clearly, the historical record is no. States can't do this on their own any more than all the other sort of factors in our modern economy that bind states together. I see that as a clear reflection of our the complexity of our economy. What about the private sector? That's an interesting question. I mean, that's been sort of debated as to what degree the private sector can take over emergency management functions. It's definitely the case that any workable emergency management plan and disaster recovery plan is going to have to involve federal, local, state, and private sector. But that's just a reflection of our government and our federalist structure. So that's not surprising. I don't know when Romney says it should all be privatized. I'm not sure exactly what he's saying there. And he hasn't sketched it out in any detail.
Well, and the word infrastructure, perhaps the most boring word. How many times have I said it? No. I mean, to be honest with you, we've talked about infrastructure a lot on Radio Times.
Sure.
And even going back to when there was Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania, Governor Schwarzenegger of California, currently Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, they issued an alert, and this was maybe 5 years ago or so, saying we have huge infrastructure problems to the cost of trillions of dollars. We must address this issue. And, you know, there's a lot of eye rolling.
It's a rare politician who will go beyond that speech and actually fight in the budget for infrastructure spending. And it's a rare president who has succeeded recently with that kind of thing. There's incentives. I mean, there's pretty good research on this that shows that voters reward elected officials for relieving them when there's a disaster, but voters are generally not tuned in much to infrastructure spending and getting the seawall ready, getting the levee ready, making sure your bridge is not going to collapse. Voters generally don't connect that with executive leadership. At the same time, that same research shows us that basically a dollar spent on infrastructure can save you as much as $15 down the line in terms of disaster losses. So there's a perverse, disincentive here for politicians not to do what you're describing, is to take infrastructure seriously. Now, one would have thought, I think President Obama did try to frame it this way, that this is a jobs measure, that rebuilding America, and he's used that line, we're going to rebuild, do some nation building at home. But that's pretty much fallen flat in the Congress. Mm-hmm. And so what we're facing, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, that grades our infrastructure every once in a while, we've got a D. We're at the D level and continue to be in this country about where our infrastructure is. We need trillions of dollars of investment. And we're seeing that. I mean, the fact that the New York City subway system is flooded now, in part, is a direct reflection of deferred maintenance on infrastructure there. And that can be now demonstrated. The question is if we'll take action on it.
Well, and it's kind of perverse in that then you've got a hurricane that's actually forcing infrastructure improvements.
Right, that you have to demonstrate the disaster before you fix it. Right, I mean, and this is this kind of disaster syndrome has been described by like Howard Conrather at Penn and others. Have looked at what does it take to actually get citizens to kind of wake up and pay attention to the risks in their midst. At that particular moment, that's probably the time to make the case. And so I'll be watching very closely, and I'm sure others will, over the next week to see if this enters the discussion in the campaign. What I'm seeing so far is a lot of discussion, rightfully, about consoling victims. But this is an opening to have that conversation in a serious way. Again, that $400 billion is quite a lot of money to lose in 10 years for really disasters that could be minimized in a very seriously minimized with some forward thinking and planning.
Scott, can you stay with us for a couple of minutes?
Sure.
Okay, well, I need to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, talking with Scott Knowles in this hour of Radio Times, author of a book called The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Scott Knowles, and we have Tricia Wachtendorf waiting in the wings as well. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Art and Theater Company, presenting Freud's Last Session on the Arcadia Stage now through December 23rd. On the day England enters World War II, Sigmund Freud invites a young C.S. Lewis to his London flat. Here, the father of modern psychology challenges a little-known professor on the brink of literary fame. Freud's Last Session imagines a collision of these two brilliant minds over love, God, and life. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or artintheater.org.
Sure, shouting angry pundits can be entertaining, but when they run out of breath, ask yourself this. Did you actually learn something new, or just get the same old spin? Trust Election 2012 on WHYY for the real story, not the spin. Each day, our team of journalists is out there finding the stories that showcase every perspective, not just one slanted side. WHYY-FM, newsworks.org, and WHYY-TV, where you go to know.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY. Penn's Master of Liberal Arts allows students to tailor their program to suit their interests. Penn MLA students pursue creative writing and urban studies, global concerns, and applied economics. Instructors and peers share perspectives that can help students hone their thinking and communicate their ideas. Part-time options and evening classes are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details online by searching Penn MLA.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Today on the show, lessons from Sandy. And again, Scott Knowles, our guest. He's a professor at Drexel University and, in fact, directs the university's Center for Interdisciplinary Inquiry, author of a book called The Disaster Experts. And, Scott, I just had a couple more questions before we have to say goodbye to you.
Sure.
Just underscoring something you said, and actually a show we're working on for tomorrow. The things that we're dealing with today that have not been or were not discussed on the campaign trail, whether it is infrastructure that we were just talking about, emergency planning, even building along coastlines and the various risks involved in that. Why do you think these were not discussed on the campaign trail?
Well, I think that the other one to mention is climate change, right? And
yeah.
I mean, you know, we could argue all day about, you know, the causes of climate change, but the fact is that sea level rise is pronounced, particularly along the eastern seaboard, higher than anywhere else in the world, apparently, and the Atlantic is warmer, so there's a lot of energy out there to have these kind of storms. And that wasn't, you know, on the table. Climate change wasn't on the table for conversation. But why aren't these things discussed? I think, Marty, you know, this is a long-standing problem, and it's maybe sort of structural in the sense that land use is almost a sacred right in American history, and it's very locally prescribed. We don't have a national building code. We have national sort of standards of the best way to build and construction standards, but they're done at the incredibly local level. And so, you know, I think when candidates don't want to often wade into those kind of conversations, I think, because they don't want to be seen as promoting the restriction of land development and of construction, because that means you're potentially restricting job creation and the development of our national economy. And so they often don't get into it, or they get into it at a very sort of bland level. But the fact is that the research is very clear. We need more mapping. We have a lot of knowledge already. We need more money spent on mapping of floodplains, for example, in this case. You know, one of the lessons from Irene, and I presume one of the lessons from Sandy, will be that if we took the knowledge we had and got a little bit more of it around weather patterns, around flood patterns, and then mobilize that into policies that could direct development in places that are safe and move development or restrict development in places that are not, we could save ourselves a lot. We could save a lot of lives, and we could save a lot of property. I'm not sure that fits in a soundbite. I know that doesn't fit in a soundbite.
It definitely doesn't sit in a soundbite. Fit in a soundbite.
And,
Scott,
and yeah, I think the bigger one of the things just to say is that, you know, the conversations around these kind of things in Europe are very different. They have a precautionary attitude towards technology and land development. That has never been our part of the American experience. I mean, our experience has always been build first, take risks, and deal with it later. And I think that has served us more or less well up until the 1960s. But the evidence from the 60s forward is that there are some places in this country where the risk is not worth taking in terms of living in a wildfire corridor or along a fault line or in a flood plain. And the question now is whether or not you can't go back and unbuild those places. So the question now is, will we invest in the infrastructures to protect, and will we spend the money to eradicate the sort of social problems that can, you know, get citizens, you know, as you said earlier, you know, will they take the warning seriously to move out of harm's way, you know? And so far we haven't spent that money in a serious way, but that's the real challenge that's facing us as we go into the 21st century with disasters.
Well, Scott Knowles, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Author of The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, professor at Drexel University. Joining us now is Tricia Wachtendorf, and she's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Delaware, the associate director of the university's Disaster Research Center. She's conducted quick response and reconnaissance field work following a number of major disasters, including the World Trade Center disaster of 2001, the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2001, 2004, Hurricane Katrina 2005, and the Haiti earthquake in 2010. And Tricia Wachtendorf, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And looking at all those various disasters and looking at how we are dealing with Sandy today, what are your observations?
Well, as I think your previous guests have mentioned, I think that the answers will really come in the next days and weeks as we find out not only how the response went, but also as we move towards the recovery phase. One of the challenges of decision-making for these kinds of events is really the uncertainty of it. I mean, the potential effects not only within a state, but on a multi-state region, and that makes decision-making for households difficult, for communities difficult, for businesses. Do we stay open? Do we close? So my area here in Newark, Delaware, we were right in the path of the hurricane. Now, of course, I'm not as close to the shore, but we actually did fairly well in terms of our house and our neighborhood. We did better than we did in Hurricane Irene. But you look at some of the other images, and particularly further north where there's tremendous damage. The emergency managers often are able to understand those ambiguities and the nuances of forecast, but it can be really difficult to convince a public that don't seem in the direct path of a hurricane that they're still at risk.
There's a very public argument going on between Governor Christie and the mayor of Atlantic City about providing shelter for people in Atlantic City. Is there a hard and fast rule about whether to stay or whether to go under certain emergency circumstances?
I think that the general rule of practice is to be better to be safe than sorry. And so there are areas that are very well prone to flooding that might not get a hit in one event, but there's a high likelihood. And so those are areas certainly that people want to get out of the area. But then there's that question mark area. And so the extent to which people actually heed those warnings, if they're in a voluntary evacuation area, whether or not they're able to evacuate if they have the resources to do it, or whether or not they have grown complacent given past events. You know, I did well, someone did well in Irene, and so they're saying, you know, we can ride this one out. The challenge of really grappling with all those different needs and attitudes and motivations.
One of the lessons that we learned from Katrina, I mentioned this with one of our previous guests, is the role of pets and how connected, and I completely understand this, how connected people feel with the animals that they live with, and that could affect their decision about what to do under an emergency situation.
Sure. So during Hurricane Katrina, many people didn't evacuate because they didn't have a place to go where they could bring their pets along, and we know that this is clearly one of the deterrents to evacuation. Since that time, it's become mandated that shelters have a plan to accept and house pets during a disaster. More importantly, when we start thinking about people, during Katrina, there was a lot of ambiguity around shelters and access for people with disabilities.
Right.
The protocol on that is much clearer today, that shelters need to be accessible for the range of needs that its occupants may have. How well that's actually implemented on a shelter-to-shelter basis is another matter, but the protocol is there. We've become much better, I think, at recognizing the diverse needs in disasters, that a one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work. Simply telling people to leave if they don't have the resources to do so isn't going to help.
Right.
Staying at a public shelter isn't a luxurious experience, but what may seem like an added feature to some people may actually be a basic need to others. Losing the power in my house for 8 hours might mean giving my kids a heaping bowl of ice cream and losing some perishable goods. But for someone else who relies on refrigerated medication or electric-assisted technology, it could really be life-threatening. So we can look at the population as a whole, but there's these pockets of needs that really need to be looked at more specifically.
Well, I would think things like nursing homes or even hospitals that you mentioned, those with disabilities, people that are infirmed in one way or another, seems to me that I guess has to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we'll probably look at quite closely in this event are the hospitals and the nursing home evacuations. So there was an effort by the state of Delaware and the facilities after Irene to make improvements after that event. Now, they haven't had a great deal of time to do that with before Sandy was really knocking on their doorsteps. But still, it's important to look at what happened here and in communities like New Jersey and New York, where they did evacuate some facilities this weekend. That's a huge decision to make because many of their residents are frail or ill of health, And moving them can pose more of a risk, be more of a trauma to them than maybe what they'll experience sheltering in place, which is usually the preferred option. That said, if they do need to evacuate, those are people who you don't want to be getting into a boat, and they need much more lead time. So those are really difficult decisions for both the facility to make, as well as the government agencies that are giving them information and will provide support.
And I think one of the lessons we've learned is am I an essential employee or a non-essential employee?
Right, right. And so even, but a lot of times there are plans that we have in place that rely on non-essential employees. So we saw that, for example, after Hurricane Katrina, where you had those images of all those buses that were flooded over, right? Now, the bus drivers, they evacuated with their families. It makes sense. They were under a mandatory evacuation order. So sometimes there's people that we inadvertently rely on to do our jobs as essential personnel. And when they aren't there, suddenly it's a surprise, and we didn't really think about them. Some of the organizations that we've talked with have done a great deal of planning. They've talked to their vendors, for example, if they're a hospital or a nursing home, or they have contingency plans for transporting people and getting ambulances. But all the other facilities around them have the same agreements with the same vendors. So it's one thing if it's an isolated incident, like a facility fire or a small areas affected, but once you start thinking about a multi-state disaster, many of those same resources where they have a mutual aid agreement in place, there might be five or six other mutual aid agreements, and it becomes much more tricky even when the planning's already taken place.
We're hearing that something like 7 million people on the East Coast are without power, and of course, you know, depending on how soon power can be up, that raises a whole host of questions. And I know some of the more rural areas, you can be without power for days, maybe even to a week or two.
Absolutely, and the challenge is not only what's happening in that household and them getting the supplies that they need, but also just getting information. So how great is it if we can check on our phone that has our battery charged on a smartphone, or to check on the computer or to make a call? Once those systems are down, even when the storm is passed, if we're not able to get information about what we need to file, where we need to file it, those can really significantly delay the recovery process as well.
We're also seeing the power of social media. I know Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker is famous for his tweets and his rescue operations. But I was seeing some tweets back and forth between him and other people in Newark, and he was running from one emergency to another. How do you see the role of social media?
Well, social media like Facebook or Twitter is increasingly providing a useful tool. So first, it becomes an important way for communities to keep in touch with each other during an event and sharing information. So I was on the computer checking if, you know, people were without power, or getting updates and connecting with friends and neighbors and so on. Second, it can be an effective way for organizations to push information out to the public. So I friended the Delaware Emergency Management Agency, the governor's office, my employer, the University of Delaware, and I could easily receive updates from them. I also have an American Red Cross hurricane app on my smartphone, so that's another way that I can get information. It's also a way for organizations to get information from the public. So although they need someone to monitor the pages closely, it can be a way to find out if there's something going on in a particular community, if there's a problem. Last year after Irene, there were some complaints posted on the governor's Facebook page about the tolls and the lineups as people were evacuating from the beaches. And someone said they would look into it, and they lifted the tolls a few hours later. So that can be really great. Of course, not everyone uses social media or has access to it routinely or when the power goes out. So it's one of those tools in the toolbox, but many forms of outreach are always necessary, be it TV, be it radio, be it community or faith-based groups in the community. Really, those multifaceted approach is going to be necessary, even when you have something like Facebook or Twitter that can be useful.
Well, let me see what Maureen from Chester County has to say. Maureen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I had called in because today I looked out the window, the tree's down on my hood, and a wire.
And
yesterday,
a wire. Yeah, go ahead.
And a wire.
Wow.
But yesterday, meaning back in 1955, I lived in Yardley in Bucks County. We dealt with, I believe it was Hazel on the Northeastern, and the Delaware flooded all the way at Delaware River to the canal, almost up to North Main Street where I lived.
Right.
My dad, Jay-Z, fire chief, always taught me to be prepared, heed the warnings both before, during, and after, and also to count my blessings, not like the frequency in the Philippines, but in the, today, more importantly, I'm giving back, and I'm going to the fire department locally with brunch, and then this afternoon, if the roads are clear and I can get my car out, I'm donating blood.
Maureen, good for you. And thank you for calling into Radio Times. Tricia, your thoughts?
And I think that your caller makes an excellent point. We often think about the formal responders or people with the very visible nonprofit organizations as playing a key role in disasters. It's those neighbors, it's those community members, whether or not you're bringing food or bringing over a shop back to help a neighbor get water out of their basement, someone in your down the block, whether or not you're volunteering in a formal and informal way. It's those efforts for those of us who actually fared well that are important to help others in these times.
Well, Tricia Wachtendorf, thank you so much once again for joining us today on Radio Times.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Delaware, the Associate Director of the University's Disaster Research Center. As I said, she has conducted quick response and reconnaissance fieldwork following a number of major disasters, including the World Trade Center disaster of 2001, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and the Haiti earthquake of 2010. We also talked with Scott Knowles from Drexel University. We heard from the American Red Cross and also from the National Weather Service. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. And certainly check us out on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though, for the second hour. We'll be right back.